Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea, I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning in today to the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology and processes. Our mission is simple. We're searching for beneficial disruption in healthcare from emerging technologies. I'm really pleased today my guest is Andrea Jacobs. Andrea is the COO of PCG Software. Like myself, she has experience both in the administrative as well as the clinical arenas of the healthcare industry. And so this is a talk we're going to have, a conversation I've been looking forward to that really has not been touched on in some of our other Tate Chronicles. Some of the most complex and time-consuming tasks in healthcare really arise because of reimbursement issues, coding issues, claims, ongoing changes in rules and regulations. So first of all, Andrea, thanks for your time talking with us today.
Good morning, Jim. It's a pleasure to be with you. This is an interesting topic for, I think, everybody involved in healthcare.
Well, it really is. And as I mentioned, with your experience both in the administrative as well as the clinical side of healthcare, you certainly have some insights that others may not have. And so just initially in the world of coding, documentation, and timely reimbursement for providers, what are some of the pain points and potential hazards and risks?
Well, I think that the interesting part of being a clinician and working on the reimbursement side of this is that I never forget that the patient is really the center of all of these kind of interactions. And that it always is in my mind when I'm looking at either the billing side or the payment side, is this is somebody's life that we're dealing with. And while I spent most of my career really taking care of patients, hands-on patient care, I'm now taking care of their financial welfare. So one of the pain points is that we know that one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in this country is hospital and medical bills that are overwhelming to the patient, and they feel that there's no way of paying these. What I see for both providers and for payers is that there's really a lot of federal, state, and local oversight into what the physicians bill and how the payers pay. Because we don't want, this should be a transparent kind of collaboration between the two. There's contracts in place, or if it's an out-of-network provider, there are rules for paying those providers. And what we expect is that the provider bills accurately what was done to take care of the patient, and that the payer comes back and reimburses them fairly according to the contract. And if we have that kind of relationship, what happens is a lot of the waste that goes on really disappears, because for a doctor to rebill, to appeal a claim that was denied, cost them about $25 to $45 in direct costs. And then they have to wait for that money. And in the meantime, there's a lot of resentment and hostility build up because, you know, doctors aren't making as much in many cases as they did in the past. We just saw that the doctors got a minimal, they called it minimal increase, which was about a nickel per RVU this last year. And that's not enough to cover the increasing costs of healthcare. Not getting cheaper for technology and those things that do help, those costs are sort of exponentially growing. So when we look at coding, appropriate coding, the correct code for the correct service is really important because it avoids those unnecessary denials on the provider side and it reduces the cost. Documentation is everything, and we see that the federal government in this year's Medicare physician fee schedule really looked at documentation, especially where we have physicians who are supervising residents and other training staff, so that they don't have to redocument everything that was done. They can review and verify and sign it, and that's going to hopefully include nurse practitioners, CRNAs, and physician assistants who are in charge of that case at that point. Because what we see is a lot of time wasted. We see doctors who are unhappy with the requirements for documentation in their EHR, and I don't know any physician that's on their first EHR. Most doctors' offices have moved to multiple different kinds of software because of dissatisfaction. And, you know, one of my physicians said she was just absolutely exhausted and finally got a scribe because she was spending until midnight every night trying to catch up on the documentation. Now, you know, before she had very voluminous notes and she was fast at writing those notes and used some kind of subjective and objective assessment and plan so that she was getting all the information down. And she said, you know, I never had denials from the health plan because of my documentation. Now we've spent $1 million for this medical group's EHR, and I'm working later. It didn't make my life easier. So, you know, all of those things, having correct coding, correct payment, correct documentation, means that the reimbursement is timely. You know, those are the things that we want to look at. And it keeps the providers out of regulatory hell, because any kind of compliance program that brings in law enforcement is going to make sure that the doctor's life is never the same. You may be innocent, but you will have to defend yourself. And we see such egregious cases now where we didn't see those in the past, where we saw, greed, but we didn't see, multi-million dollar greed. And, I know that the other day I saw a case where the doctor told patients down in Texas, I think he was down in Mission, Texas, that they had rheumatoid arthritis, and he prescribed for years these toxic medications, and the medications were really harmful to the patient's health and safety. And in addition, his greed caused him to be enriched by $325 million for these false diagnoses. Well, that's not only criminal, it is unethical. And he took an oath to do no harm to patients. And instead, he did everything he could to get richer and at the same time, injure these people's lives forever. And, he's going to be sentenced soon. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
False Claims Act. That's the False Claims Act.
Yes.
Well, this whole process begins with correct coding based upon documentation. We often hear about overcoding. We don't hear too much about anybody complaining that they've been undercoded, which in terms of regulatory issues is still is considered false coding. What we want, just as a baseline, is correct or right coding. And so tell us a little bit about PCG software and the type of software and work that you do to address these issues.
What PCG software does is develop applications for healthcare providers and payers. And we want to have a transparent relationship between the providers and the payers so that they're using the same rules to bill and to pay. All of the rules that PCG software includes in their virtual examiner suite of products and then into the IVE coder for providers are based on AMA, CMS, World Health Organization, CDC, and the federal government rules, so that there's no mystery about the rules. It's just that there's lots of them. Currently, with this quarter's update, we update the software at least quarterly, and any time that CMS or Medicaid comes out with a major change, and we have about 45 million edits. And those edits are date sensitive, so there's a start and a term date, so that they're always applying the correct edit to the claim that comes in based on the date of service. And what we do is we have a whole staff that does nothing but review the change requests, the transmittals, the MedLearn network stuff for Medicare and the Medicaid programs, looking for what are things that should not be billed together or should be billed, so that when the tools are used, it gives messages to either the payer or to the biller that this is not a good coding combination, or the diagnosis doesn't match up to the code that was billed. One of our great stories is we went in to do a demo for a client, and they had paid for total OB care with a diagnosis of headache. And we all laughed because we have kids and we know that it's a headache, but that was not an appropriate diagnosis and they had paid the claim based on that. So we try to make sure that everybody understands what these rules are. It's too many rules for anybody to remember. And while we have great CPCs out there, professional coders, they can't remember everything. They can remember that there's something there, but they have to do a lot of research. And what we do is we do research really fast. You know, we're looking at processing someplace on the provider side. In seconds, they get an answer. They don't have to look through books. They don't have to look through tables. They don't have to try to go to the different MAC websites to get information. It's all right there in front of them. Same thing for the payers. The payers, we have all of these rules, and what happens is the software not only looks at today's claim as it comes in, but it looks at the episodes of care that that patient has, so that we're looking back. Did they have a new patient visit in the last 3 years? Did they see somebody on the same day for the same problem in the same practice? We really look at the claims not only from a software application side, but we also look at it from a patient side. What really happened to this patient? You know, and a lot of the reports that are derived from the claims data are used by medical management to look at who's an outlier, who has the best outcomes, you know, who uses inappropriate modifiers. If we're going to send our patients out to somebody, do we need to have provider relations go out and work with this provider? And for the doctor's office, we're trying to provide a cost-effective solution. Our software costs about the same as the books that you buy in order to bill correctly each year.
Well, so you're working on really providing services to both payers and the providers. I'm just curious, Andrew, do you have any really even rough estimates of medical practices? What percent of their claims are rejected on the first submission?
Well, we know that it's probably between 5 and 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And we know
mm-hmm.
that because we look at the denial rates from the payer side.
I see.
Know, we're not aggregating sure. data from the providers, but we're aggregating data from the payers. And if they're denying 5 to 15% of those claims, a certain percentage of those should be reworked. We see doctor's offices where they find that they're so overwhelmed with all the duties that they have just trying to take care of patients and get the first bill out that they really don't have a means of checking to see why it didn't work the first time, what they should should have done. And that's where our, you know, IVE Coder tool comes in. It can help the provider appeal appropriately and say, well, this was a CCI edit, but we used the appropriate modifier, and here's the documentation to support that this was a separate site or a separate session or a separate provider. So, you know, we want to have the provider have tools, but there are still a lot of denials out there.
You know, one thing I experienced when I was working at a large specialty practice on the clinical side, but I had insight into the administrative side, and that when there were claims submitted and they were declined or rejected, they would come back to be reworked. And so the folks that were involved with that, that was a secondary effort. When they finished all their current work, then they would rework the denials. Well, they never got around to denials. And so sometimes if something was rejected, it literally never was looked at to be corrected. So I would imagine that a pretty high percent, I don't know what it is, but of that 5 to 15% never gets reworked.
It never does.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you mentioned on the provider side your coder. Tell me a little about how that works on the provider side.
Well, yeah, go ahead. Not every claim that's going out needs to be reviewed. Let's say it's just an office visit. You know, it's a 99213. It's an established patient. They're coming in for a cold. The doctor puts in the diagnosis, and the coder, the professional coder, can either use a book and flip through all the pages, or they can depend on the EHR. Well, we know that almost most of the big practices in this country are using EHRs, and they still have a 5 to 15% denial rate. And the reason is because the EHR is not a human brain. It can do some things and point you in the right direction. But what we see is manifestation codes used as a primary diagnosis, which is never going to be allowed. So what IVE Coder does is it is the ICD-10 coding book online, and those rules come up that say, oh, this is a manifestation code, you need to pick a primary code, or the digits that you build are not complete, you need to add more information to this diagnosis for it to be accepted by the payer. So that would be just a simple lookup, or it may be that you want to look at the financials on this. You know, am I billing correctly for the right place of service? Is there a site of service determination where if I do this at the hospital, I'm going to get paid one way. If I do it in my office, I get paid in another way. Sure. So all of that information is included in IVE Coder, or you've got a J code and you're going to administer medication, and now all of a sudden you can't find the box for the NDC code. You can look up the NDC code online and then have somebody look in the invoices and make sure that it's the right one. So it is really a great lookup tool. Plus, it's got 45 million edits in there. And that is the difference between being profitable at the end of the year and not having a lot of denials, and then when the denials coming in, having really a good basis for what did we use to build this? All of those reason codes that come up that say this is the reason this wasn't payable or the payer's not going to consider this, we know where that information came from. And we have, you know, coding staff that will help support the client that they call up and say, I don't understand this. I don't understand why this was denied. And then we will help them with either their local Medicaid rules or with the national rules to make sure that they have the information that they need to overcome the denial determination.
You know, I've been involved in the certification of health information technology probably for over 10 years, Andrea. And I can remember when EMRs a while back actually provide some type of coding support. And that seems to have gone away, and I guess the coding support has gone into standalone applications. Have you seen the same thing? Did you experience that?
Oh, you know, I was just at, I've been to two coding conferences in the last quarter, and what we found is that people were still using their EMR to, as a basis for coding.
Right.
And for some people, they thought that that was great, but when I asked them what their denial rates were, their response was very close to your experience, where they were really busy and they didn't work all those denials. And so I asked things, do you really track the reason that the code didn't get paid? Do you fix your EMR? Do you really look to see that you're not billing deleted codes or the wrong diagnosis, things that are easy to fix? And most people feel so overwhelmed in their day-to-day operations. And then they also say, well, I turned that over to IT and I'm waiting for them to fix it.
Right.
And that becomes a serious problem. You know, I think there are some really good standalone products. You know, we take pride in ours because we have worked with payers successfully for over 25 years now. And those payers use our software to look at every claim. We want the doctors to have the same opportunity so that they have the same information. And we've had lots of payer clients say to us, I wish our provider network had your tool so that they didn't have as many issues in billing us, because we don't really want to be in the denial business. We want to be in the payment business.
Sure.
But we don't want to be paying for services that weren't provided to our clients, our members, and beneficiaries.
It seems like there are probably two points I gather from that. One is you could find out really the status of a provider's organization as far as doing well on claim submission, just by what percent of their claims are rejected. That would tell you something right there. But also, it's not just the rejection rate, it's that you have the right coding. I've seen practices where they're paranoid to code at appropriate levels, so they drop down one level in their encounter code.
We see that also. And, you know, when I would get encounter information in, especially from capitated providers where they billed everything as a 99213, and that is a established mid-range visit, they think that's a safe visit to bill, that no one's going to look at it. But, of course, immediately they become an outlier, because we do bell-shaped curve analysis. We're looking to see, is there a normal distribution of the office visits by category for the physicians in this network by specialty and in a geographic area? So I'm not looking at doctors in California compared to doctors in Iowa. I'm looking at Iowa physicians who are all cardiologists, all in the same geographic area. And I'm looking for normal distributions of those office visits, from a very minor visit to a very complex visit. If they don't fall closely within their peer group and also into the CMS benchmarking for office visits, they're an outlier. And, you know, it may be that the doctor's not trying to overbill, but he will be overbilling because the people who really had a lower level of care all got the same visit. And that means he's also underbilling, and that he is losing revenue. So, you know, our goal is not to put providers in jail. That is, it defeats the purpose of being in healthcare. Our goal is to have the health plans, you know, provider representatives and network representatives go out and show the doctor where he's going wrong in his billing practices. And some of this is just an information transfer. You know, we looked at your billing and compared it to all the cardiologists in your area, and this is a problem. We're concerned about it. If we as a health plan in the middle of Iowa found this, you don't think that you're showing up on other payers as an outlier, and eventually CMS will get to you. because no one wants to have overbilling or underbilling because it doesn't represent really what happened to the patient. And frequently, doctors have billing services or they have somebody at the front desk doing their billing who is not really educated. Or the billing service is getting, you know, paid, and they don't care really what goes out. You know, there's no quality control. And I've seen doctors when I've gone to, like, the OIG conference where they're teaching doctors who have corrective action plans what they did wrong, say, well, you know, I just trusted my billing company. There's no quality process where anybody's going in and looking to see that the bill that they sent into the billing company really represents what they sent in. Because if the billing company is getting a percentage of the collections or the percentage of the billed charges, the doctor can be put into jeopardy almost immediately because they have no compunctions about billing for something the doctor didn't do. And we see those kinds of frauds perpetrated, and the doctors standing back saying, well, I know I signed all those claims, even if it was an electronic signature, but I didn't know what they sent. He has the responsibility to make sure that the claims that go out in his office are correct, just like he has the same responsibility in his office to make sure that there's no theft of patient monies that are coming in, and we see that all the time.
Andrea, I can't believe it, but we're almost out of time. I want to make sure that our audience knows how to get in touch with you, how to get in touch with PCG for more information, how to get a demo. What's the best way somebody get in touch with you?
The best way is to either call me. The office number is 877-789-1291, and I'm at extension 203, and one of our salespeople, Gary, can be reached at 212. The other thing is there's lots of information on our website, which is www.pcgsoftware.com or www.ivecoder.com. And they have information so you can contact us through the website, and there's demos and YouTubes and all kinds of things so that you can see how we operate. Our best demo is for you to see the software in action, either IVECoder or when we do demos for payers. What we do is we take 3 years of their data and run and do a virtual examiner analysis of their data. And then we go out and present that so they have an idea of what the potential is. And we've had clients go back and recover money. And if you have federal and state contracts, you're required to go back and recover money if you can. So, you know, and for the doctors, when we've gone in and said, these are areas where you have, you know, problems, let's look at rebilling these with the better codes and seeing if we can't recover some of that money.
Well, Andrea, that contact information is helpful, and the offer to go back and run that data through is, I'm sure, eye-opening a lot of folks when they see that. I'd like to thank our audience for joining us today on this episode of the Tate Chronicles. I offer a special salute to my guest, Andrea Jacobs, the COO of PCG Software. Andrea, thanks for coming aboard today.
You're very welcome, Jim. It was really a pleasure.
You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tate Chronicles transmission ending now.